Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, we will re-air some of our favorite recent conversations on this summer Friday. We'll hear about how businesses in the sharing economy, like Zipcar, are disrupting the traditional economy. We'll talk to a founder of Zipcar. Why love songs might deserve more respect, and we'll play snippets from some of the great ones. And you know all those products that promise to delay aging or are marketed as anti-aging? Well,
you can't be anti-age. It's like saying you're anti-breathing or anti-living.
That's the medical sociologist and journalist Ann Karpf. She'll try to disrupt some of our usual ideas about age on today's program. But first, the great intellectual disruptor, Malcolm Gladwell, for example, on which college to go to. In his latest book, David and Goliath, which is out now in paperback, there's a chapter called, If I'd Gone to the University of Maryland, I'd Still Be in Science. So let's start there as we welcome Malcolm Gladwell back to WNYC. Hi, Malcolm. How are you?
Hi.
And since we did the general book interview when it first came out in hardcover, I thought we might spend some time today drilling down on this one really interesting chapter.
Yeah.
And you actually begin that section of the book with a story of a 19th century, early 20th century art salon in Paris where Manet and Degas and Cézanne were all participants. Would you tell us that story to start setting up your point?
Yeah, there was something. There was an institution in Paris at that time. Where all the artists submitted their work to a kind of central government institution that chose the best works and displayed them. And this radical group of upstarts, the impressionists had to make a decision about whether they wanted to play by those rules, to be in the big pond, or to go off on their own and to set up their own little show and play by a very different set of standards. And they chose to be big fish in a little pond, not little fish in a big pond. And I think that explains in a certain way their rise to prominence.
They abandoned that salon system, that officially sanctioned establishment art jury system, and went off and started their own thing so they could do the impressionism that was meaningful to them but that the jurors might not appreciate?
Yes, they traded. They gave up on prestige in favor of freedom. They felt it was more important to be able to do what they loved doing than to be lost in a very different, much more conservative, much more sort of competitive environment.
You have Monet disagreeing with Manet.
There were many arguments among this sort of group. They would meet in these cafes in Paris. And this was a constantly on their mind because in the art world at that time, the salon really dominated the profession. It was what everyone thought about was trying to get into this very privileged, selective institution. It was, I start with that because, of course, it's a beautiful analogy to our obsession today with getting into the most prestigious school that we can, right? They were faced with the same question that high school graduates are faced with.
So that brings us to the story of Caroline Sachs, top of her class in high school here in New York City, and the particular decision that she had between going to Brown or going to the University of Maryland. And as the story begins, it doesn't seem like much of a decision at all, does it?
Yeah, Brown is obviously a far more prestigious school, Ivy League school, incredibly difficult to get into. Here we have this brilliant high school graduate who is at the top of her class in everything, wants to study science, and chooses to go to Brown. And I interview her 2 years in. I sit down with her, and she gives me all of her regrets. She explains to me what the cost of going to a really great school was. And the cost was that she ended up dropping out of science. And the whole chapter is an exploration of this idea, kind of taking the example of the Impressionists and talking about the same set of choices that students have today. And that is, we understand what's good about going to the most prestigious school imaginable, but we never talk about the costs. And the costs are considerable. And particularly when you think about STEM, about people who are interested in studying science and math, there's a whole body of literature now in psychology and in educational literature that looks at why do people drop out of science? Because that's the big issue. It's not that there's a lack of interest in science in this country. It's that many people drop out.
And you write that what Caroline Sachs was experiencing was what sociologists called relative deprivation. What is that term?
What that means is that when you're a student and you try to come to an assessment of how good you are at something, you judge yourself according to next to the people in the classroom with you or in the school with you, not according to some very general standard. You're not judging yourself against the whole world. You're judging yourself against the students that sit next to you in calculus class. And if you go to an elite school where you're surrounded by very, very strong students, chances are that you will think less of your abilities than you would if you went to a school where you were in the top of the class. And that's what happened to Caroline Sachs. Here we have a truly brilliant student who goes to one of the finest universities in the world and feels stupid and struggles and ends up not pursuing the thing that she's very good at and that she loves. Why? Because she chose a school that was too good. And she realizes that had she gone to Maryland, she would, which is a very good school but not at the level of Brown, she would have been in the top part of her class and not have undergone that period of that process of demoralization.
Malcolm Gladwell's book, David and Goliath, now out in paperback, subtitled, by the way, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. And it looks like we have a parent who you influenced in this direction, Sammy in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hello, Sammy. Sammy, you there?
Yes. Hi. Good morning, Malcolm. I'm a big fan of yours. My daughter skipped Harvard and went to University of Toronto. And over there, she finds students to be very down-to-earth. Even though they're smart kids, they're not the kind that graduate from Harvard who wants a corner office with $1 million salary. And then you come out in your life practically doing nothing but making money. But over here, you have Amish neighbors who actually make equipment that works not on fossil fuel but compressed air. Mm-hmm. Now, if this strategy is adopted in our society, then we'll have factories with less automation that won't kill jobs. What do you think?
Well, I love the idea that your daughter has gone to the University of Toronto because, of course, that's where I went. So I can't help but say that's a brilliant choice. But
I don't know if he made the whole thing up just to get in his pitch for compressed air technology.
Just to catch my attention. But no, it is interesting. You know, that's the classic example of what I'm talking about, that there is paradoxically more freedom in less elite universities, where you have the ability to try out many different ideas, many different subject areas, pursue many different passions. In the absence of the kind of overwhelming competition that exists at Ivy League schools, you have a chance to get an education. Right? That's what an education is allowing yourself to experiment as many things as possible. I could never take math at Harvard because I'd be surrounded by Einsteins. I could take it at a lesser school, right?
But, you know, I was talking to a friend recently about this very idea, guy who went to an Ivy League school, mm-hmm. undergrad, and then a more ordinary graduate school. I will protect all the names to protect the innocent and the mm-hmm. deserved and undeserved reputations of any institution. But, you know, a more ordinary place for graduate school. And he said the level of his peers mm-hmm. was different and less satisfying mm-hmm. in grad school from what it was at the Ivy League institution. And he wondered about your theory. Like, it might be right for some kids, like Caroline mm-hmm. Sachs, but for others, they might be drawn down toward mediocrity by a more mediocre student milieu.
Yeah. Well, I think that I don't mean to suggest in this argument that one should never go to an elite school. What I'm saying is the choice of what school you go to ought to be made on an individual basis. You have to look at the student and say, where do you think they will best thrive? And it is not the case for everyone that the best place to thrive is the best school they can get into. So with your friend, it sounds like he's someone who was near the top of his class. If you're going to be near the top of your class at an elite school, by all means, go.
And he was. Peter in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Brian. So I just wanted to question a little bit this idea that in humans inherently in the way they judge themselves are only making their judgments on sort of the people who they've surrounded them with immediately. that just seems to me like an oversimplification of the way humans sort of conceive of themselves. A whole lot of the time we're judging ourselves against the images that we have that might not even necessarily be an actual experience or externalized ideas that we've gotten from, you know, cultural constructions in various different places. And in order to sort of place ourselves and our ability within this greater context, we're looking at all sorts of things beyond just the local people we're going to school with. Mm-hmm. So while I appreciate that some people can run into this problem, it's just strange to me, the idea that this is some universal cost of like a really high achieving school. It seems more like a very subjective, specific experience that certain students are going to run into.
Well, there is, I will say, you're absolutely right, I think, to say that this is the process by which we decide how good we are is a complicated one. There is an enormous literature going back 25 years now in psychology, though, that looks specifically at the question of when you're, let's say, a high school student, when you're in the process of forming your own identity, as you are in high school and the early years of college, you are in an acutely vulnerable position, and you are actively trying to figure out, where do I fit in the world? And of course you draw cues from as many different places as you can, but the ones that really resonate with you are the cues of your everyday experience. So if I'm trying to figure out whether I'm good at calculus, the most salient bit of evidence I have is what happens when I take calculus. And so where you take calculus makes a big difference, which is not to say, it's not the only thing that matters, but it is in that crucial stage of human development. This is an overwhelmingly important consideration.
Peter, thank you for your call. You also use data in the book showing how often graduates of Harvard and MIT got academic papers published mm-hmm. if they were in the top 1% of their classes as opposed to merely the top 20%. Can you talk about that?
It's a fascinating study that was done looking at the publication rates of PhD graduates from elite economics programs, or not just elite, economics PhD programs around the country. And what they discovered is that the most successful economists are those who finished at the top of their class regardless of the school they went to. In other words, the top student at a mediocre school ends up being a more productive economist than simply a good student at an elite school. So if you're hiring, you're better off hiring the top student from the University of Kentucky than you are from hiring the fourth or fifth best student from MIT, which is something that
is pretty counterintuitive.
It's counterintuitive, but it's a study that blew my mind and has blown the minds of many people in this particular field.
Jessica in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Hey, so I wanted to share my experience along this topic. I always wanted to go to RISD when I was in high school. I'm 27 now. It's like all I wanted. I carried around a RISD bag, Rhode Island School Design, everywhere I went, and I got in. And went to the Accepted Students Day. Okay, seemed great. I went to the Accepted Students Day at SUNY Purchase as well. And I was just overwhelmed by the feeling of how much I would belong there. And I love the faculty. They're all incredible. Everyone I met just seemed like I would want to be friends with them. I just really felt the sense of I fit in there. And I went there, and I have absolutely no regrets. It was definitely the right choice for me.
Another very strong, full disclosure, my brother is on the fine arts faculty at Purchase.
Yes, I know.
but another excellent, but kind of, they go, for people who don't understand the context, they're going for some of the same things that RISD is going for.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, but this speaks to something which has happened in our consideration of colleges, which is we've become obsessed with one variable. We've become obsessed with how selective and prestigious the school is, as if that's all that matters. And in the truth, right. There are so many other things that matter. And an education is a personal. You're not acquiring a Fendi bag or a Prada shirt. You're developing your own mind. And so it makes sense that you should have a far more expansive definition of what good is.
Malcolm Gladwell with us here on WNYC. His book, just out in paperback, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. So now that we've thoroughly confused people, more they were confused before the show started, as they consider this decision, what's your advice for seniors and parents listening right now, deciding among colleges that accepted them? Because, as you're saying, it can't just be choose the lower-ranked school.
No, it has to be the most important question is, what is the institution that will allow me the greatest freedom to pursue what I love? And we know that one of the best predictors of that is any institution where you can thrive, where you can be one of the better students, is the one that will maximize your freedom to pursue what captures your attention, imagination. So that's the first consideration. And the second consideration I would be is that stop worrying so much about prestige. I mean, everyone, once you graduate from school, trust me, the prestige value of the brand name of your institution ceases to matter all that much. You don't get a job because you went to Yale. You get a job because you're a hardworking, interesting, reliable person. I mean, these brand names that we're obsessed with at the age of 18, by the time you're 25, have faded into insignificance.
Let me take one more call here, because I think Jim in Brick says this doesn't just apply to students making decisions, but also to professors. Jim, is that your point?
Yes, hi. And hi, Malcolm. I used to go to Toronto, but not to the university. I was at UVM, and I was telling the screener my gradient was that the chairman of the departments are often crusty, and they see it their duty to separate the chaff from the grain. And an assistant aide could explain an ionization solving problem in a much clearer way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yet people run in the, you can see the other, you know, going through the bookstore, they're looking for, you know, the chairman who teaches that course rather than an assistant professor.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, which actually raises another interesting question, which is that we are far too obsessed with the name of the institution and not obsessed enough with the particular individuals with whom we would like to study. You know, imagine a world where you sat down and said, I would like to study English history. And then you went and you previewed 20 or 25 of the top professors in English history, and that's how you chose your school. That's a far healthier way of approaching things.
So while you're here, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I thought we might touch on a few other things briefly, if we might, that you've been up to. I read that you interviewed venture capitalist Bill Gurley at South by Southwest the other week. He invested early in things like Uber and Yelp and Snapchat and Twitter, and one of his claims, according to what I read from your about your conversation, was that the proliferation of Uber as an alternative to yellow cabs makes the road a safer place in general. Now, that's an interesting claim in the era of Bill de Blasio's Vision Zero, where the public cares about this more than they used to. How did Bill Gurley back that up? And as a data guy, how much did you buy it?
I totally buy it. And for one very simple reason, which is that the role that alcohol plays in traffic fatalities remains enormous. You know, we think we've solved that problem. We have so not solved that problem. We're talking about upwards of 10,000 Americans who die every year because of the presence of alcohol in their system while they're driving. What Uber is doing and what services like Uber are doing is they are making it possible for people, mostly young people, to go out at night and drink and get home safely. Easily and safely. And you're seeing in cities
More than other taxis?
Yeah, I think that there is. It's interesting. You wouldn't think there's that much of a difference between Uber and other taxis, but there is. It's so much easier for people to, and the cars come so much more quickly.
Because it's right there on the app.
It's right there on the app.
And the kids are using the app.
And you go to places like LA and you see that people are now going out on a Friday night and leaving their cars at home. That never happened. And trust me, when they run the numbers, that will translate to fewer people dying.
And at least so far, they're usually cheaper than yellow cabs, except for these moments of surge pricing that have been getting all the attention for price catching.
The funny thing is, after I interviewed this guy, Bill Gurley, I went from my hotel in Austin to the airport the next day, and the surge pricing on, I called an Uber, the surge pricing was 6.1. I ended up paying $200 to get to the airport. So I was brought back down to earth very rudely.
Yes.
That Uber has good things, and also it can...
You can get screwed.
You can get soft, yes.
Your New Yorker writing recently seems largely book reviews over the last year. You getting into that as a genre?
No, it's just because I've been busy. I have a big... I'm going back to reported pieces now. You're making it sound like I'm slacking off, and I'm...
No, there's nothing slacker at all about the book review, which is an incredibly high art, I think.
Yeah, no, but it's less work than a reported piece. I think that's...
But one of them was the Steve Brill book about the creation of the Affordable Care Act, and you called it a Bob Woodward-style reported book. How much did you like it?
I didn't like it as much as I wanted to like it. I felt that he got lost in the detail. And there were moments where I felt like he didn't understand the business, the industry he was trying to describe. And also, you know, he spent a lot of time on the difficulties with the Obamacare website. You know, what's funny about that to me is that at the time that seemed like a big deal.
Who remembers the
Obamacare? Does anyone care? And by the way, why is it news that someone comes out with a website that's buggy in the beginning?
Duh.
You know, the first Apple phone was buggy, and no one said that Apple was a disaster as a result.
And you also reviewed one that asked the question, why black gangs don't lift families out of poverty like the Italian gangs, the mafia did for those families. What book was that?
Well, that was a number of different books but it was something I thought about for a long time, which is that the organized crime that involved the mafia, when the mafia was in its heyday, existed at a time when the police and law enforcement was really lax. The mafia was essentially allowed to do whatever they wanted. And as a result, what you saw was mafia families were able to make the transition from the criminal world to the legitimate world. Today, that doesn't exist. Today, if you're in organized crime or any kind of criminal activity, the cops are all over you. I just thought it was very curious, you know, that used to be that crime was an engine of economic mobility. It really isn't anymore. And that's I just thought that was a fascinating little fact about the evolution of American society.
That is interesting. Somebody told me that you were an early proponent of stop and frisk as a crime reduction strategy, and then soured on it. Do I have that at all right?
Yeah, I do. I do think that when I talked about why crime declined in New York in my first book, The Tipping Point, I don't think either I nor other people understood enough about what effective policing is. And now I am much more skeptical about heavy-handed police tactics. I think like everyone else, I've learned from Ferguson, from all kinds of things, that there's a point at which policing can be almost too effective, right? Too oppressive.
And the book is David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. A lot more to come. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. A lot of people find their identities in college, but few find something as fundamental as what race they are. Our next guest is the creator and focus of the documentary Little White Lie. She's Lacey Schwartz. Lacey grew up in a family rooted in tradition in Woodstock, New York. Her parents were white and Jewish, and so was she, as far as she knew. When she was young, her parents attributed her dark complexion and tight curls to her great-grandfather, who was Sicilian. The black girls in her high school weren't so sure.
The black girls would stop me in the hallway and say, "What are you?" You know, like I was offending them. And I would just tell them that I was white, that I was, looked like my great-grandfather, who was dark-skinned. I would tell them I was Jewish.
It was not until she applied to college that Lacey began to see the truth. Although she didn't declare a race on her application, She says Georgetown University considered her a black student based on a photograph. After this validating judgment, Lacey began digging around for the facts. What she found were family secrets, lies, and collective denial for all these years she has been, as Lacey calls it, passing as white. How and why are the questions of Little White Lie, the documentary by Lacey Schwartz, who joins us now. So nice to have you. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
One of the first lines in the film is that you grew up in a family that, quote, knew who they were. How did you mean that phrase?
You know, I think within families, there's so much of pressure to conform, really, to be who we are, to kind of bond over one thing in particular, not to recognize each other's differences. And I think for my family, we were Jewish, and that's who we are, and that's what our identities were cemented around.
And so you were told you were Jewish, you were raised Jewish, and because they knew who they were, you felt you knew who you were. It didn't occur to you that you were, as you say, passing as white, because really you were passing to yourself, weren't you?
Right. I really had no idea. I mean, as you said, this is such a coming-of-age story, and it's my own coming-of-age story, but it's a story where I grew up, and I believed I was who my parents were. I was an extension of who they were. I didn't have an idea of thinking about myself as something separate from that until really I went away to school.
When was your earliest memory of thinking, I look different?
It was really the first memory that I have of somebody else telling me or questioning the way I looked, which was in nursery school when another student said to ask me what color my gums were and to show me his gums.
Show him your gums?
Yeah, show him.
Because he was seeing your gums as somehow
Well, I think
different.
He was seeing my skin and was looking for a way to categorize my skin color and thinking, well, are your gums the color of my gums? Are they different? That's how I will be able to judge that.
Right. And there are various points in your childhood that you refer to in the film where your identity is questioned by others and starts to plant the seed of your own questioning, that nursery school incident, and then at your bat mitzvah, a synagogue member told you it was nice to have an Ethiopian Jew in their midst.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in the Jewish community in particular, it's hard for us to also imagine ourselves from different from each other. There's been such a kind of reinforcement of this image of being like a white Ashkenazi Jew. And so when I was growing up in the 90s, the only idea that people had around Jewish diversity was Ethiopians.
And that clip we played from the film, referring to black girls in high school being offended by the fact that you were declaring yourself to be white.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for them, they were looking at me and they were thinking I was passing, probably maybe consciously passing, denying who they were, denying who I was, and that really reflecting on them.
So you got all this way, you didn't know who your biological father was or had any reason to suspect that it was somebody other than the dad who was raising you, right, or that the race would be different than your mother's. If you didn't declare your race on your college application, because that's part of your story, you applied to Georgetown, did not declare a race. Were you already feeling unsure about what it was?
Absolutely. As you said in the intro that, you know, the power of denial is so strong and it's a very big piece of my story. And I think for me, like everyone else in my family, I had my own denial around the story and it happened in different phases. So for me, really, from the time my parents broke up when I was 16 and before then, I was in complete denial. From that phase on, I think I was really just lying to myself and wasn't willing to acknowledge what I really saw. Not until I went away to college was it when I was really able to fully ask the questions.
But you had a biracial boyfriend in high school who also thought you were biracial, and he says in the movie, white people will believe anything. Want to talk about that?
Do you want to talk about it?
I want you to talk about it.
Yeah. No, I was kidding. Yeah, I mean, I think, it's interesting. His perspective on this story is one of the few people in our town who was kind of a person of color and thinking he was looking at this situation and thinking, I get this, I see this in a way that not everybody else was talking about. And certainly my family in the kind of three circles out were not talking about it. You know, do all white people believe everything? No, but this idea of if you say it is, we can believe it, we can create our own reality around it, I think is what he's really alluding to.
Maybe if we go to Starbucks, we can really talk about
this. Right.
But how did Georgetown come to categorize you as black without you declaring it?
So as part of my application, I was asked to submit a photograph. So based on a photograph, they admitted me as a black student.
Based on a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And you got accepted as a black student. You got invited to join the Black Student Alliance. And you went.
I did. Yeah. you know, I think, as I said before, I think my real questioning started around the time my parents split up and this bubble that I had existed in was kind of popped at that time. I had that biracial boyfriend who was really in my face, pointing a lot of questions at me. And so by the time I got to Georgetown, I was ready to explore my identity. I was ready to try to figure it out. And after that first year of being at Georgetown and being, you know, not identifying as being Black, but actually being a part of the Black community for the first time, I then went home and asked my mother some of the real questions.
And you had been seeing a therapist, I guess, in those early days in college, who was encouraging you to confront your mother. And so here's a clip from the film as Lacey prepares to confront her mother. Lacey's mother is in this clip too, in fact, speaks first, remembering that moment just before everything came out.
Lacey came to me and said, "We have to talk." It was like, oh no, I'm scared.
She initially didn't want to talk to me about it. She told me she couldn't do it at that time. She had to do something else first.
My reaction was, please make her be quiet. Make her stop for a while.
And I told her I had to talk about it. I wanted to talk about why it looked the way it did.
Lacey would ask, how come you never talked to me about it? How come nobody ever talked to me about it?
And I said to her, Mom, you have to tell me.
How come nobody saw that I was different? How come nobody thought enough to come to me and say, I know the truth?
And the truth was that she had had an affair with a Black man, Rodney Parker, who was actually your biological father. And he was someone you had actually known growing up, right?
Absolutely. He was somebody my mother met back in the day, and he was around. You know, we lived upstate, but when we came into the city, I would meet him on occasion. He was, as I say in the film, he was a ticket scalper, and he frequently got our whole family tickets to various games and concerts and whatnot.
A family friend.
Mm-hmm.
What did he play any other role in your life growing up? Did he ever pay any special attention to you? Did he know?
I think my thought on it is that Rodney was probably the first person to really figure it out and know. But he, not necessarily. I mean, it wasn't.
Even he had to figure it out so your mom didn't tell him in the first place, Rodney, I'm pregnant with your baby?
I don't think my mother had that thought. I mean, I think, as I said before, like everybody else, I think my mother was very much in denial. I think that she thought that there, I don't think she, my mother had this uncanny ability to not always think things through if she didn't have to. And so I think she didn't realize it as well. And actually, if anything, I think Rodney was probably the one who said to her at some point, you know that that's my child.
Mm.
And that was probably what made her have to stop her own denial.
So did you confirm that through genetic testing or something like this? Because it seems like a matter of suppositions, and just from based on what you're saying, maybe the sequence of events was that you could have been somebody else's child?
My father's child. I mean, you know, I didn't do that because I thought, you know, but honestly, by the time it all came out in the open, it seemed pretty obvious. Many people say that I do look just like Rodney.
Yeah.
So that connection seemed pretty strong.
And your father in the film ends up being, I think it's fair to say, less open than your mother on the subject. He had less to explain because he didn't know the truth that much before you did. I guess he only found out that he wasn't your biological father when you were 16. So here's a clip from the film where you talk to him about identifying as a Black woman.
There's certain things that I'm being a little bit vague for a second, but there's certain things that I would like to talk to you about, but there's a difference between saying what I'd like to do and what I need to do. And one of the things that I've realized that I need to say is I need to openly acknowledge to you that I identify as a Black woman.
What a surprise.
But I've never said that to you, Dad.
All right, well, you didn't have to.
And the reason I
see the books you read, I see the relationships you have, I see the music you like, I see the entertainment realm that appeals to you. Okay, what else is new? I knew that.
But he never wanted to talk about it with you.
No, he didn't. I mean, obviously, I think when you watch the film, my father has his own pain and his own issues around it. And I think it's a really complicated thing in terms of his relationship with my mother, my identity, and then our relationship and how all of those things connect together.
Why did he agree? Why did your mother agree to have these conversations with you on film?
You know, I obviously can't fully and totally answer that. But the answer that I have is I really think that of the many privileges I experienced, I come from a loving and supportive family, a family that I think definitely made mistakes like most families, but one that supported me through. And I think it became pretty clear when I came to them and said, I'm going to do a film, and really I'm going to do it regardless, but I'd like to ask you to participate in it. Everybody agreed to do so, and I think that that really comes from the fact that in the end they do support me.
I want to take some phone calls for you. People have had, you know, obviously people have all kinds of experiences, and you're a living example of that. Exactly. Janet in Pine Bush, you're on WNYC. Hello, Janet.
Good morning.
Hi there. What's your story?
Well, my story is that until I was 16 years old, my family told me that my father had died. And it wasn't until I was 16 that I found out that, in fact, he had not died, that my parents had had a bitter divorce when I was an infant. And they did this with the best intentions in the world. I was a happy kid. It was, you know, not a bad childhood at all. It was a wonderful childhood. But it did, when I found out the truth, it did shake me up and just changed my relationship with my mother and aunt who shared the raising of me, because I felt that I had been deceived in such a profound way. And I discovered the truth when they had become lazy about keeping the story together about how he had died, and I thought, gee, one guy can't have died of so many different things, or he was the unluckiest person in the world, you know?
Lacey, what are you thinking as you listen to Janet's story?
You know, what I'm thinking about is the fact that what motivated me to make this film is really about how much family secrets can have effect on so many of our identities, and really for me, it is about the process of digging into that, having these difficult but important conversations on them, and figuring out a way to move forward. I totally understand what Janet's saying about how it affected her relationship with people. But for me, I was very much in the space where I was conflicted, because I had an amazing, supportive mother and family. But I also realized that I needed to deal with some of the secrets that they had told. So I really believe in the process of it. And I actually would implore that other people check out, where on our website are creating a space where people can share their little white lies as well, at www.littlewhitelie.thefilm.com, and join in a conversation around those and give other people a place to share that and move past it.
Janet, I'm curious, did you then go seek out your dad?
I did, but that was in the days before internet and stuff like that, and I basically had almost nothing to go on except for half of an Army serial number. So, and my mother said she had no idea where he was anymore, and I believe that to have been true. So it was a frustrating search, which I undertook again about 15 years later when I had a child of my own. And I mostly wanted to know everything I could about any medical issues that might be genetically part of her life. But no, I never did succeed in locating him.
Janet, thank you for sharing that story. Now tell us about the website again. You're getting story. You're soliciting stories. I didn't know about this. You're soliciting stories from people.
We're giving people a space where they can actually go online and share their little white lies, their family secrets, and ideally sharing what motivates them to share it, like why they want to dig into it, discuss it, and move forward. And we're going to be building out, as this project is going to continue to grow from our PBS broadcasts. We're also releasing digitally on iTunes on March 31st and going beyond. So we really want to give people a space to talk about their little white lies and move past them as best as possible.
What are some examples of things that you're already getting?
I mean, the kind of things that Jen just said, paternity issues with sexual abuse, which obviously is incredibly unfortunate, but also about race, about finding out you have other siblings, all, you know, people who had like mental health issues in their family that weren't talked about, eating disorders, that kind of thing. It really runs the gamut. Their own issues with mental health, drug abuse, that kind of thing.
Benita in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Benita.
Hi, Brian. Welcome back.
Thanks.
I'm calling because I have a very similar story, and it's interesting to me because it's so complex, the matter of identity, particularly when the biracial parents or interracial parents are both Black and Jewish, and how Judaism has such a strong hold, but so does Blackness. And in my own family, that was the situation with my parents. I'm 61 years old, so I was the product of taboo. But I have an older brother who actually, from the time he was 21 and recognized, I was 16, he was turning 21, and decided that he did not want to identify black. And I did identify as black. And my brother decided that he would have a better life and was convinced, because of the Jewish influence, that he would actually have a better standing in the world. That created such a divide. I love my brother, but I have been angry with him and angry with my family about his decision and the impact then that it has upon me to hold his secret. Secrets are really sick, and people are within, hidden within that sickness, the darkness of it, the burden that gets carried. And I have allowed him his latitude, but I will not lie for him.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, I am who I am, and I'm proud of my blackness, and I identify I have children. My children identify as being black, but this is really such an interesting and complex subject. So I applaud Lacey for bringing it, especially because she's younger. And it's interesting to me in the 90s that she would grow up and not know who she was, you know, really who she was, that her parents would have not told her. And I wonder about the anger that she may have felt and how she's dealt with that.
Benita, thank you for sharing. I mean, I think that, first of all, in terms of the 90s, it's amazing to see how many kids are still growing up with this. I think it's a misconception that, you know, that there isn't this racial complexity that still exists, that's like an outdated thing. I think we're still struggling a lot around that. You know, in terms of my own anger, you know, I hear what you're saying about your family, and I think somebody asking you to lie for them is incredibly complicated. But what I realize, again, going back to, is that I really valued my relationship with my parents, and even though they had made a lot of mistakes, they were relationships that I wanted to treasure. So I needed them to accept me for who I was, and I needed to go through this process. But at the same time, I then needed to accept them for who they were and accept what they could and couldn't do. And that's what I was able to do, and really individuate myself and make sure that I wasn't lying for them. I mean, I think that's very, very complicated, that I wasn't lying for them and that I could therefore move forward in my life. And also hearing your story raises something else for me that I think is so fascinating, because so many people question me about my racial identity and, well, if you're in this situation, how do you connect? And I always say that, you know, racial identity is so subjective, the way you connect to it. And when you're in a family where you, especially kids who are biracial, and two siblings can feel so different, that to me really sums up how complex and nuanced and subjective racial identity can be.
Benita, are you, if I may ask, darker than your brother?
No, in fact, that's you know, there's so many complicated and intricate parts of this, of my own family story. No, in fact, I am fairer. It would be a lot. People automatically assume, because of my first name, that I'm Puerto Rican. And given that I grew up in Bed-Stuy, and, you know, there are so many assumptions based upon my exterior. And so I could have, and I think when I was younger, you know, took on more of what stereotypical language might have been, the intonation of my voice, and, you know, how I walked and how I dressed. Well, I didn't take on those things. Nevertheless, I am firmly rooted in my identity. My community is black community. So, no, it's real interesting. My brother, his lie is that he's a Sephardic Jew, and therefore, you know, that's why he's dark. And he has made himself, he doesn't live in New York City. I mean, he had to extricate himself, and so he's done that, which is the painful part of the alienation of holding the lie.
Right.
And the,
he went to somewhere where it's easier to pass, it sounds like, right?
And, you know, I want to say one more thing about you asking about my anger, is that I think really I had to dig down and realize it, as you said, I think at a pretty young age, that I was stuck. I was stuck because of the story. I was stuck because of the secrets in my life. And I wanted to move forward. And it was really out of self-preservation that I didn't want to live my whole life being a victim to this story that I could have gone through and felt justified in my anger, felt justified in people wronging me, but realized that being a victim to this story was only going to really and truly hurt me more than anyone else. And cutting off those relationships would hurt me. So it was really about how can I dig in and move past this as best I can without being a victim.
Benita, thank you so much for your story. It's really, really moving and troubling. You want to do one more? Amazing stories on the board from people, and everybody can go also post your stories to Lacey's website, which is what again?
www.littlewhitelie.thefilm.com, and then click on share.
And Francine in Plainfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Francine.
Good morning. I've been listening to this young woman's story for the past couple of days, and it brings up something for me that is weird, and that I didn't find out until I was 9 years old that my father, who had just passed away, was married and had an entirely different family from mine. He didn't live with us, but I just kind of thought him and my mother didn't get along. And when my mom found out that he died, and it was the day of his funeral, I was told that I couldn't go to his funeral because his family was there. And as I've gotten older, that it was always a weird thing for me, because now I know, you know, I knew at that point, they explained to me that I had 6 sisters and he had 12 or 13 brothers and sisters, and I've never gotten to know those people because I was the secret.
You were the secret, and you were barred from your father's funeral.
Yes. And it's funny, as my daughter gets older, and she's a mixed child, trying to explain to her my family history becomes a little awkward, because now both my mother and my father's dead, so she doesn't know any of her
right.
people.
And yet it sounds like you want her to know everything. You want her to know the actual truth.
I wanted to know where we're from. Because she's biracial, her father's family, she knows everything about them being Irish and where they come from in terms of the U.S. and where they come from in Ireland, but I can't tell her any of that about mine.
Francine, thank you. And I'm sorry for that trouble. And it segues into the last question for Lacey Schwartz, which is that you now have 2 children of your own.
I do, yeah.
So what's one thing you teach them from the experience that you've had?
You know, my kids are super young, so, you know, they don't actually talk yet, per se. But I think, you know, listening to that story, I just think that kids can handle the truth and the reality a lot better than we give them credit for. And I think if we raise them to feel like the truth is not something that should be stigmatized or should be looked at negatively, but kind of just is what it is, and that they're loved and supported no matter what, that's the best way to do it. You know, my family, from my husband's side and my side, has lots of different people in it for them. And so I'm going to explain the connection and not put any negative connotation around any of it and not hide any of the story. It just is what it is. And I'll raise my kids to teach them about that at those appropriate ages.
Lacey Schwartz, both the creator and the focus of the new documentary Little White Lie, which you can watch now on Netflix. Thank you so much for sharing your story. You've obviously touched a lot of people and touched a lot of chords with folks who are inspired to bring out some of their stories, too. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll continue after the news with Ann Karp, who wants us to not only accept aging as inevitable, but embrace it as a good thing. It's a tough sell. We'll see how she does. That's coming up as we continue here on The Brian Lehrer Show with some of our recent favorites. First, here's the latest news, live right now from the WNYC newsroom. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer Show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And how about this contradiction on the cover of one of the women's fashion magazines this month? The cover line screams, "Fabulous at every age," beside a picture of Julianne Moore, but with the subhead, "Look younger instantly." So is it fabulous at any age, as long as no one guesses what it really is? How do we walk that line at any age between denial and resignation when it comes to getting older? That's the subject of the latest book from the London-based School of Life Philosophy Group in a book called How to Age. School of Life is the center started by Alain de Botton to help develop what he calls emotional intelligence through the help of culture. And we'll be checking in with several authors in their how-to series this year. We already talked to Sarah Maitland about her book, How to Be Alone. Maybe you remember that segment. And right now we're joined by Ann Karpf, a medical sociologist and a BBC broadcaster, whose book is called How to Age. Ann, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much, Brian.
What's your take on that magazine cover? Is the answer to how to age to not let anyone catch you doing it?
Oh, my goodness, the shame of looking older. You know, it's something so terrible. You need to go to such great extremes, such great lengths to conceal your age. Isn't it extraordinary over a relatively short period of time how signs of aging have become so shameful? Because it wasn't always the case. I mean, I remember even when I was growing up, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, although I think it did begin to change in the 1960s, it wasn't to this extent. I mean, now, young women, particularly women from the age of about mid-20s, are being targeted with all kinds of skincare about, you know, reducing the signs of aging. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that there's a lot of anxiety setting in very early. So, as you say, we've got this contradiction. We're living longer, healthier lives than ever before, and yet a lot of us are getting more and more anxious about aging from younger and younger.
Is your basic premise to embrace aging as something to be celebrated, or more simply that it's just a waste of energy denying it?
It's both of those things. And Brian, you use the word resignation. I would challenge that word. I would say more acceptance. I mean, you know, of course you could say, well, you could say nobody likes getting older. Well, I'm not even sure that's true. I was chairing a session at a conference yesterday of 250 people, wonderful conference in the centre of London. I had on my panel all Americans, as it happened. And, you know, people were talking about the aspects of their lives that were far improved when they got older. And it's interesting because I wrote a piece for the New York Times earlier this year, and I said I wouldn't go back to being 14 for anything. And someone wrote a letter saying, yeah, Ann Karpf may say that, but what about 34, 44 or 54? And frankly, I wouldn't go back to those times either, because there was, you know, I mean, I'm not exactly the most serene, laid-back person now. I don't think I've got the serene gene. But, you know, my life is, I've got a much stronger sense of what is important in life. And I don't think that's particular to me. A lot of older people say they begin to care less what other people think. They have got a sense of what the priorities are in life, and they're very conscious that life doesn't last forever, and so you have to savour it. And I think those are some of the real gains that you get through life, as well as experience. You know, there are certain situations you deal with better, not all of them, and I'm really reluctant to swap one stereotype for another, so I don't want to idealise ageing. There are all kinds of challenges around ageing, particularly in the cultures we live in the West, that so demonise and stigmatise it. But I still think that it's more than resignation. It is more of a celebration, because it's a privilege to age. You know, people all around the world would be very glad to have some of our wrinkles and some of our longevity.
You know, we have this myth, Anne, that there was a golden age when we revered the aged for their wisdom, and only now do we see it as a disease to be cured or hidden from sight. But was there ever such a time?
No, there wasn't. And I'm really glad you pointed that out, because I think there is a tendency always to idealize the past. And I think it's a much more complex, sort of nuanced picture if we look back. Because on the one hand, when people were very poor in subsistence economies, you know, an extra mouth to feed who didn't contribute was really a very serious matter, because it reduced what was available for everyone else. And so if you look back in the past in Western cultures, but also in traditional cultures, you know, in the developing world, I mean, the horrible things that people did to old people, you know, chucking them off cliffs and leaving them to die in the wilds, are pretty awful. And we can be thankful that we don't do that explicitly, at least today. But there was something that was different, and I think that we need to try and recover, and that was a sense of understanding of the having a sense of the life course and the lifespan, and understanding that each stage of life was important, and seeing meaning in old age, and being able to value old people's experience, which was essential, particularly in oral cultures, where old people could pass down absolutely necessary, vital pieces of information and culture and rituals. So people understood that there was a very important role for elders. And one American historian, Thomas Cole, has talked about the demeaning of old age. And I think it's a very good, nowadays, it's a very good word because it means two things. It means demeaning in the sense of taking away meaning. We don't see a meaning in old age except it's the prelude to death and we identify it with death, which we're so terrified of. But also that we demean old people and we treat them with contempt and shame and you know, in the hope that we're never going to become them. And it's always them and not us. And I suppose what my book is trying to do, and I think it's part of a whole movement that's starting up now, is to encourage people to identify, not to disidentify with older people, to identify, and also to recognise that ageing is not something we do at the end of our life or from the age of 70 or 60 or 50. It's something we do from the moment we are born, we are ageing. So to be, you know, I see all these products that say anti-age, and I want to shout back at them and say, in that case, you're anti-life, because ageing is an intrinsic part of life. You can't be anti-age. It's like saying you're anti-breathing or anti-living.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Do you risk falling off into a too feel-good philosophy that denies a certain piece of the reality? I mean, if aging inevitably means worse functioning by your body eventually, which nobody wants, and brings us closer to death, which you just pointed out, nobody wants. I mean, you use Winston Churchill in your book as an example of somebody who did some of his peak work at an older age. His contemporary Charles de Gaulle famously said, old age is a shipwreck. So can we really celebrate aging as opposed to merely adjust to accepting something that is fundamentally an unhappy reality along with whatever may be good about it?
Well, again, that's a good question. I have to say, you're the first person who's ever accused me of being feel good. a colleague of mine, when I did a broadcast once about optimism, a colleague of mine at the university where I teach said, you'd have to look the word up in a dictionary. Now, I think one very important thing to recognise is there is no such thing as a typical old person. That, you know, there's a lot of evidence that we become more diverse and more different from each other as we age. And among the critical factors shaping how we age are social class and income. And if you're poor, you're going to have a very different experience of ageing from a person who is comfortable and doesn't have to worry about keeping warm, you know, and having enough food to eat. So I try not to idealise old age because I try and recognise the variety and diversity among experiences. I mean, as to be, you know, the fact that it brings us closer to death, all the more reason to celebrate it because it's a sign we're still alive, you know. I mean, to squander that time, you know, I actually argue, I have a chapter that I call a very short chapter on death, and I argue that we need to integrate an awareness of death and a thinking about death throughout the life course and not just confine it to being towards the end. But also, Brian, you talked about inevitable decline. Well, again, people decline in different ways. Some things decline, other things are enhanced. But I think there's a tendency to look at aging in two ways, very much to do with the body and very much to do with the individual. And in fact, I wrote an article for the Guardian newspaper a couple of weeks ago on the whole concept of age-friendly cities. And the whole point about these initiatives, and there are over 200 now around the world who've called themselves age-friendly cities, is that they're thinking of the individual in the context of the environment. Because it's not about, you know, whether just about what your mobility is. It's about how much your environment it takes account of people's differing needs and accommodates them. That's what makes you more or less mobile. You know, I've got a dodgy left knee that comes and goes. Some days it's good, some days it's bad. But, you know, if there are steps everywhere and no lifts, that is what determines whether I can get to places. So I think that, you know, it's very important to think in those terms. But also, if I could just say one other thing here. I mean, the quote I love most is of a 90-year-old woman. Now, she had some disabilities. She had some, you know, what you might see as impairments. And she was asked why she was a volunteer, because she helped out in various local centres. And she gave a two-word answer. She said, personal growth. And I love that, because that's a 90-year-old woman and she's still thinking how she can develop and grow until her final breath. And that's what I'm arguing for, because I'm not saying, you know, I'm very much against age denial and, you know, look, we can pretend we're not ageing and we're not going to die. But I think that doesn't mean we can't remain vital. And you know, and I accept, I repeatedly say in my book that one needs throughout the life course to mourn, because at every stage, you know, people get to a certain stage in life, they look back and they think, you know, I didn't do this, this didn't happen to me, this didn't happen to me. One needs to mourn what didn't happen in order to leave space for new things to occur. But I don't think that's a task only for old age. I think one needs to do that. You know, my younger daughter just left school this last year and very excited, you know, gone off travelling, is going to university in the autumn, but also terrified, you know, leaving the safety of the home for the first time properly. And there's a lot of grieving involved in that. So I think that that is a task that we have to return to again and again throughout the life course. And that helps us to age more fully and zestfully.
Anne Karp, medical sociologist and BBC broadcaster and author of a new book called How to Age, part of the School of Life philosophy series. And Norma in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Anne Karp. Hi, Norma.
How are you? I was just saying that I don't come right out and lie, but I avoid saying my age. I'm a middle school teacher, and I've been teaching for 25 years. And, you know, my friends tell me that I don't look my age, and I feel like I have a young spirit, and I think that if my students knew how old I actually am, that they wouldn't feel that they could relate to me so easily, because I do have a good rapport with a lot of my students and even former students who are in high school or college. And, you know, and I find now that, you know, because I've been teaching 25 years, and I love to go out dancing and clubbing, and people my age, they don't do that. I'm, you know, in my late 40s. They don't like to do that. I'm running into my former students when I go out dancing, but I don't want them to know how old I am, because I said I don't think that they would, you know, relate to me once they find out, you know, that I'm their mother's age. Like, I don't want them to know that I'm their mother's age or older than their mother,
yeah.
Because, you know, I don't think they would want to talk to me the way that they do speak to me.
So, Anne Karp, do you judge Norma for the way she lies about her age?
I don't at all judge her. Hello, Norma.
Hello.
I was just having a conversation with my older daughter yesterday about a similar subject. And, you know, Norma and me, we live in a very ageist culture where people are full of prejudice. And I can absolutely understand why she's, you know, not. She's trying to avoid actually stimulating those prejudices in people.
Right.
I mean, people say to me, Norma, oh, you don't look your age. And I remember what Maggie Kuhn, the fabulous co-founder of the Grey Panther movement in the United States, said to me when I interviewed her about 30 years ago. She said, we'll know things have improved when you look your age is a compliment.
Right.
And I thought, gosh, we're a long way off that. I mean, I always worry when people say to me, you don't look your age, and I feel all pleased, that, you know, it's I'm on a hiding to nothing, because at some stage I will look my age, and then will I feel, you know, really bad about it?
Well, exactly. So I go out to a club, and I wonder when they turn on, I'm dancing with someone that I know is significantly younger than me. When the lights go on, he's going to say, oh, my God, this is an old lady, you know? Or I went to Trinidad Carnival, and I'm dancing, and someone who was an older person than me said, what would her students think if they saw her? Like, why do you get to be a certain age and you can't enjoy going out dancing? You can't do certain things because you're a certain age. So that's why
absolutely.
I avoid, you know, because
and
that,
Norma,
that's a good
you
point,
know,
right, the prejudice.
Norma, you're doing the best thing for aging, I think, for aging in a very active, great way, and that's dancing. I love dancing, and I dance all the time.
Yes, I love it. I love it.
In fact, I heard the other day that in Manchester, in the UK, there's a club that, you know, mostly is frequented by people in their 20s, and once a month, it's a very hip, cool club, once a month, they have an evening for people over the age of 50, which I thought sounded great, but then I thought, why can't they just integrate the 20-year-olds and the 50-year-olds?
Exactly.
That would be ideally.
Exactly, because my 50-year-old friends, they don't dance like I dance. I dance like my
Norma, have fun clubbing tonight.
Tomorrow night.
Excuse me.
Thank you. Have a great
Thanks
weekend.
Thanks for a great call. Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning, Brian. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm an African-American who used to live in Brooklyn Heights, and I would ride from Brooklyn Heights to White Plains in under 17 hours. 17
bicycle.
I was an A rider.
On your bike?
Yeah, on my bicycle. 35 miles. Less than 2 hours.
And now?
Now I'm 58 and on the Manhattan Bridge, because the Brooklyn Bridge is like crazy to ride your bicycle on. Rollerbladers have passed me by. Oh, wow. Not fun.
So how are you dealing with this?
I accept that I've gotten old and I don't have the physical ability to ride at, like, I can do maybe 12, 13, but there's no way I can do 17 anymore.
Sounds like you're still laughing.
Well, yeah, I love to ride. And hey, they just raised the subway fare another quarter, and I'll probably ride the subway maybe 6 or 10 times a year.
Ann, you want to get in and talk to Michael?
Well, I am so impressed by his riding prowess as a non-cyclist with a dodgy knee. It sounds pretty amazing to me. So, I mean, I can understand the feeling of loss of not being able to do what you could do before. But I think, wow, you sound like you're doing pretty well.
Michael, thank you for your call and happy cycling.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful talking with you.
You too. Anne, I loved your analogy of tree rings in the book to explain why a 40-year-old feeling 18 is not necessarily Peter Pan syndrome. I think this really relates to our previous caller, Norma, that 18-year-old self is still very much in there in the 40-year-old.
Yes, isn't that interesting? Because you meet some people and you can really sense that they're not very connected with their younger selves. And then you meet someone like my 80-year-old husband, who, I mean, there's a photograph of him from when he was 13 at school with he's looking at the camera with a cap on and a very mischievous expression. And I look at him today and honestly, I see the same thing. Now, that isn't to say he hasn't changed, because that would be terrible. I was talking to a friend of mine recently and she said, when people say, I've known you for 30 years and you haven't changed. She says, I think, God, what was I like 30 years ago? But, you know, it's not that my husband hasn't changed. Of course he's changed. You know, he's grown older. He's got more wrinkles. There are certain things he can't do the way he could do when he was younger. There are certain things he does better. But he's got that continuity of that young, mischievous boy still very evident. And I think those people who can you know, really keep hold of that. I mean, we've all got that, the potential for that inside, I think. For some people, life just knocks it out of them. Their life is too hard for them to keep hold of those earlier selves. Or maybe those earlier selves aren't mischievous, happy ones, you know, on the contrary. I mean, I feel in my own case, I'm the daughter of Holocaust survivors. So I had quite a tough childhood. I feel like my 14-year-old self really was rather serious and much less able to save a life than I am now. And I think if at 14 I could have looked forward and seen my life now, wow, I wouldn't have been able to believe it. So, you know, we're all different and we all have a different relationship with our younger selves. But I think if one can keep, you know, contact with those earlier selves, it's definitely enriching in life and one is less liable to believe some of the ageist propaganda that we're surrounded with.
One more call. And it's Sheila in Manhattan. Sheila, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Oh, hi. Two problems here. One is I am in my late 70s. I still play 3 to 4 or 5 hours of tennis a week. I'm in very good shape. As some of your brother's callers have said, I don't look my age. I can't get a job. And I need to work. I need it psychologically and emotionally. I come from an advertising PR background. And I need to interact with people. Which brings me to the other part of the issue is that at this point in time, a lot of my friends are dying or they are incapacitated in such a way that they can't interact anymore. So those are two issues that I do not like about my particular age, and thank God I'm healthy and still mentally, I still have my mental facilities.
Very serious issues. And Anne, you want to talk to Sheila? And Sheila, do me a favor. I think your radio is on in the background and it's pretty noisy, so if you could turn that off for the rest of your conversation, that would really help. But Anne, Sheila raises some serious stuff.
Yes, she really does. And the death of friends is really, I think, a very painful thing. It hasn't started to happen, touch wood, yet with me, although I've got a lot of friends who've either had treatment for cancer or having it now. But touch wood, they're okay at the moment. I mean, there's nothing one can do about that except support them and grieve for them and celebrate the friendships one's had and be open to making new friendships. But that doesn't take away from a terrible feeling of loss, which I think obviously does happen as one ages. The one about work is a really important and interesting one. In the UK, there's been a group that's called the Age of No Retirement, which is trying to challenge those kinds of ageist ideas about work. I mean, of course, you know, age of no retirement is a double-edged thing, because if you're doing a manual work or very hard work, the last thing you want is not ever retiring. You know, you actually have earned some peace and rest and you want it. But for a lot of us whose work is in a different sphere, particularly work that isn't so physically demanding, you know, work provides so much that's important of sustenance and interaction. And I'm afraid that you are a victim of, you know, Sheila, of a lot of prejudice that's around now. And that's why people lie about their ages and try and conceal them. I mean, I don't know what the legislation is in the United States. Here now, we have no mandatory retirement age, which isn't to say there isn't a lot of prejudice against older people. For example, employers feel they don't want to train older people, whereas older people are exactly the people you should be retraining and updating their skills. So it's a really difficult issue, and there's no easy answers except keep trying and try and, you know, obviously you must know other older people, and there may be organisations in the United States that are really trying to battle on this issue. I mean, I think it will change, and I think as the population grows older, in 10 years or so, we'll see something very different, because that's no help for you because you want a job now. And just, you know, I wish you very good luck in your attempts to get one.
And that
thank you so much. I know that Canada now has just done away with the mandatory retirement at 65, a little bit late for some people. But now I think at one point, as a matter of fact, I just know that they were just taking people right out of their seats at age 65 and saying, you're finished, you're out. And I think that has just been rescinded.
Sheila, thank you for your
call.
Sheila,
if I could just say one last thing to Sheila. My husband got his job at the age of 72. So, you know, don't despair. Keep trying.
What field
he says they
he
can't. He's in university as a researcher. And he said, they can't, you know, he's 18. I says, they can't sack me because of my age because they only hired me at 72.
Sheila, thank you for your call. And Ann Karp, thank you so much. You've obviously made a strong connection with a lot of our listeners. Her book is called How to Age. It's part of the How to series in the School of Life Philosophy Group series of books that are sort of philosophy, sort of self-help. She's a medical sociologist and BBC broadcaster. We'll do more authors in this series as the year goes on. Ann Karp, this was great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Coming up next, the sharing economy, disrupting old markets for better or worse with the co-founder of Zipcar. Stay with us. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we are more than a decade deep into the peer-to-peer economy, Zipcar, Uber, Airbnb, and so many others, including the controversies they generate. My next guest is the co-founder of Zipcar, Robin Chase, and is here to talk about her new book called Peers, Inc., How People and Platforms Are Inventing the Collaborative Economy and Reinventing Capitalism. Robin, welcome to WNYC.
Howdy.
And I was surprised just a minute ago when I was asking you off the air how you might like to involve callers in our conversation that you were raising the huge political issues of global warming and capitalism in general. That's a lot different than coming on and cheerleading for Uber over traditional taxis or Zipcar over traditional rentals. Why do you go there right away?
Because what this book is about and what I want people to see is that Zipcar was a precursor to the sharing economy, but there's also a much larger thing that's going on where we are now, companies are now building themselves in a way that they employ people and use other people's assets in a much deeper tie. So, yes, we're all familiar with Uber and Airbnb, but think about Twitter and YouTube and Waze. All of those are new ways that businesses are being built that are leveraging excess capacity and building a platform for participation and inviting in diverse peers to participate. And that is completely reshaping how companies decide to build themselves because it's much, much more resource efficient. They can grow and scale much faster, and it really changes the name of the game. So
do you think this should assuage people's concerns about capitalism to any degree?
No, I think we're getting another bite at the apple. So we spent the last 150 years building industrial capitalism and really centered around companies getting as big as possible and as close to monopoly as possible and ripping out all forms of specialization and customization. Everything was very standardized. And with the rise of the internet, we are now able to happily deal with small, tiny local parts. So we have this new way of building businesses that is getting the best of both worlds, I think, the best of what platforms have to offer. And so you can think about Airbnb and Uber and Zipcar that are doing all the things big companies need to do. They're building fantastic UI, great apps, getting fancy insurance, economies of scale, and we're getting the best of what people have to offer, this localization, customization, specialization. So we are able to deliver the best of both of those worlds simultaneously, and that is a new frontier.
You write in the book, when you would approach investors for your pitch for Zipcar, one of the concerns they expressed to you was that Americans only wanted to own cars, not share cars. How did you know they were wrong?
I knew they were wrong because I was one of those people. And I think economics drives a lot. And as we become more urban, and those of us living in cities, and particularly your listeners, if you don't need a car to get to work, that means 5 days a week you are not using a car. And the average cost of owning a car in the U.S. is $9,000 a year, $9,000 a year, $23 a day. And so if 5 days pass and you're not using that car, it is incredibly expensive. So I knew that if we could offer the way to just pay for what you're using, it was a huge economic gain. And back to this idea of excess capacity, I think we've all been forced to buy more car than we wanted. We've been forced to buy either a whole car, or we've been forced to buy car rental in these 24-hour bundles, even though you want it 2 hours or 26 hours. So we've been screwed. And Zipcar leveraged technology to let you buy what you want. And from the ego piece, what I find is that economics trumps that, and people actually get to drive those cool cars. So I know that when we put Mini Coopers in, you know, people were showing up with their dates, and I've got a Mini Cooper, and you want to impress your boss, well, then you drive the fancy BMW. Like, you get to have the car that you want to fit that particular trip. Mostly, we are just concerned about getting from A to B. But
so that's one of the things you can do with Zipcar, is look for the kind of car you want and where that car is parked and available at that time?
Yeah, so let's talk about the benefits of sharing over owning. When you own your own car, and during those years, I had a minivan to accommodate my three children, and I had to have the one blasted minivan no matter what I was doing, where I was going, and it was always parked in front of my house. If you're a Zipcar member, you can use the car that fits that particular trip. You never, ever have to maintain it. And when you're in New York and San Francisco and Boston and 12,000 cars around the world, I now have my personal fleet at my fingertips. So if I look at it and I think it's actually the higher and better and smarter and better form of access to a car than owning one. When you own one, you got that same blasted single car parked in front of your house for everything.
Does Zipcar charge more to take a BMW out for a few hours? I don't know if you have BMW, than it does to take a Chevrolet?
Yes, and that was actually a huge breakthrough, that when we were starting the company and pricing, people thought that every car should be the same price, and I would actually say, so in New York City, are you telling me that every apartment is the same price across the board, whether no matter where you are, the size of it, and cars and locations are just like that, location, location, location.
And Peter in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hey, so I just had some questions about the idea that which we see offered so often in the media, that the internet is inherently such a democratizing force in this way. I think it has the potential to be, but especially combined with things like the rise of robot technology and the rise of independent, sort of the ability of computers to process things which they never were before, it seems like the combination of the internet with these things allowing people to control sort of organizations from large physical distances could allow like one or two people to be conducting, you know, networks that would previously have needed hundreds or thousands of people to work with. And even just to take the example of cars you're looking at right now, Zipcar is certainly wonderful if you're someone who has like a middle class background where you're able to rent a car when you need one. But conversely, if we look a little bit to the future and there's a fleet of, say, 1,000 self-driving cars that's rented out by a company that's owned by one person, and there's no jobs for any of the people that used to drive the cars, and you're stuck in a minimum wage job making less than $15 an hour, it seems a little bit silly almost to say that then this is a sort of the sharing economy is going to
create jobs,
elevate you or create a wealth for you.
Peter, thank you.
Peter, excellent, excellent question. I'm so glad you brought it up so early in this as our first caller. You are absolutely right. You are so right, and that's why I wrote this book, because we are in the middle of this transition, and what I can tell you categorically, what I predict, is that every company will be building according to this model, because for them, it's cheaper, and it shifts the risk, and they can grow faster, and they can learn faster, and they can adapt faster. So for companies and governments, this is by far the best way to go. So the question remains for all of us as workers, what is the future that we want? I think everything that can become a platform will become a platform, and it's going to have dramatic effects on employment. So what do we do with those productivity gains? Do we let it go to the 0.01%, or do we transform in America how we give social safety nets, how we do workforce regulation? All of those things right now have been set up for the old industrial capitalism, where the expectation was you're going to work at one job. And the future, I have this great line that someone gave to me, which was, my father had one job in his lifetime, and I'll have six jobs in my lifetime, and my children will have six jobs at the same time. And so we are, right now, 30% of Americans are doing freelance work, and there's definitely going to be, in my view, a lot more unemployment coming. So I want to challenge us. I think we need to start talking about a basic income, and we need to talk about equity, you know, income redistribution, and we need to talk about transforming rules and, you know, what is the Bill of Rights for people who are working on those platforms? All of this needs to be discussed, and I want us to discuss it sooner rather than later when it's too late.
That might mean higher taxes on yourself if you are, I don't know, your actual finances, obviously, but if you created Zipcar, you're probably doing pretty well. And it might mean greater regulation in terms of labor for whoever works for your company. You're good with that?
I think that we are dramatically undertaxed right now. Let me give you the statistic that I have that I stumbled across. I was just dumbfounded with. A person did a study on, during times of economic expansion, who gets the benefits of that expansionary period. Between 1949 and 1953, post-World War II, the top 10% of Americans took 20% of the gains. That seems okay. 2009 to 2012, the most recent expansionary period, the top 10% took 116% of the gains. The bottom 90% fell back 16%. But most remarkably, the top 1% took 95% of the economic gains. So I look at that and I think,
Not okay.
And I bet those people could have half as much money as they have, and they would still be having more than they need. So we just have to look at that top.
But as I look at your book, it seems like you have three basic recommendations for regulators. And one is less regulations on startups that are experimenting, loosening taxes. I don't know if loosening is the word you use, but regulation in general. Increase labor standards, but not by a government. So how do you increase labor standards, not by a government, to take one of those examples?
So I want to be a little more nuanced that one of the things we're seeing, I would say the internet is an example of a platform for participation. And the reason the internet was so wildly successful is that people could participate without asking, that they could just get up and do this thing. And if we'd had it so that every time you made a website, you had to go get some special line, promise that you weren't doing any pornography, certify that you were going to do whatever it was, we wouldn't have seen the economic growth we had on the internet. So I look at things, let's go to Uber. Who should be, do we really want every single driver to have to go to a government office or fill out some certification, get some background check, when we know right now that Uber, as a company, can do a background driving check on people that exist, see how many accidents they had. They can go look at their criminal record that exists already and put that burden on Uber. So I think that we definitely need to be paying attention to these things, but I want to push it up to the platform level. But those rules are still based on what we as a society think are important. I think people should be well insured. I think we should care about common issues.
Since you mentioned Uber, we had the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commissioner Mira Joshi on recently to talk about how to regulate Uber. And she said, no. We wouldn't make regulations that are targeted at one company, but rather at sectors. Listen to this 30 seconds.
Our role in terms of regulating Uber the same as we see our role in regulating every sector. And I don't look at regulating companies. We look at regulating sectors. So it's the black car sector, the taxi sector, the livery sector, the green taxi sector. And there's always, you know, a few basic tenets that we strive for consistency among those sectors. And they surround accountability, accessibility, safety, and availability.
So as a general set of principles, does that make sense to you?
I like a lot of what she said, and I'm slightly amused. In 2012, Uber was barred from entering the market, just as straight-up taxis, not the UberX, because they did not conform to the TLC's method of measuring distance, which was you had to use the TLC's approved device, and GPS was not an approved device. So just to point out that the trouble, one of the major issues with government right now is that it is so lags behind technology. But to then another point she said is she says, we should regulate the green taxi sector and the black car sector and the limo sector or whatever. And when I hear those words, what I see is that we are regulating and protecting status quo industries and being anti-competitive. So if I want to take a black car versus a green car, does that really require different kind of standards? Like, are there different regulations there that should be applying? So in Miami, for example, there's a regulation that as a black car, you're not allowed to take a trip that's closer than 15 minutes from now. And that was to protect the hailing industry. Or another incredible example, in London, which has the cabbies there have protested Uber in London. I feel like those cabbies should have been protesting their own lobby, their own industry, because in London, those cabbies are required to take the knowledge, which takes them 3 years and 12 tries to pass, yet GPS exists.
Yeah.
So we have these rules that are ancient, rules that make no sense, and rules that are anti-competitive. And those rules, let's throw those rules away, but they're rules that I care about, like safety. Yes, we should be well insured. We should have things that are...
Right. Those are fascinating examples. I wonder, though, if people might hear you as not tempted to go too far in the other direction when you give the example of how maybe instead of the government checking the backgrounds of the drivers for all taxis in the broader taxi sector, let Uber and other companies do it themselves. Why trust a private company to do it? Would it just be fear of lawsuits that has them do it? We had an earlier guest was the New York City Department of Investigation Commissioner on the private contractor Corizon that was providing health services at Rikers Island. And they were not doing the background checks. And they had people with all kinds of records winding up working in the prisons, which if the government was doing the background checks might not have happened.
I think we have a lot of sectors where the government is supposed to be checking to make sure that companies are following the rules. So we can think about meat inspection or health. You do these restaurant safety audits or health audits. So I think that's a very common thing, that you put the regulation onto the platform of the bigger company, and the government's role is to do audits to make sure that those things are actually happening. It doesn't mean that it's one by one individual that we follow those rules.
Mike in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Robin Chase, co-founder of Zipcar and author now of Peers, Inc. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call again. I'm concerned about the effects on the society's stability. It sounds like she's promoting, basically survival of the fittest. I understand things are changing, but even in ancient times, they always had regulations to protect certain industries or whatever.
To protect certain industries from too much competition.
Yes.
So you think government should decide that some industries, as they've been in the past, should be protected from competition in the marketplace?
Not completely, but I'm saying, like, for example, Uber, many of the drivers for Uber are part-time drivers. Well, taxi cab drivers who drive full-time, what is their future? I don't know. So I think there's a question of how it affects society as a whole.
I think you're making also, again, very good points. One of the things right now that we have been taught to decide, that we've been taught to think is the best form of employment, is full-time employment with someone who's going to pay all your benefits and you're employed full-time. And that's been what we've been taught for the last 100 years. And that's when you get a job, your mom says, Robin, go get a full-time job, get with benefits. But we are moving into a place where companies are trying, like the Dickens, to not offer full-time jobs. Think about Walmart and think about FedEx. Like, they're doing everything to not offer full-time benefits. And if we think about governments and companies, when they look at their own revenues, they've been told to diversify their revenue stream, that every company and every government is thinking, I want to make sure that, or the city of New York, we're not just tourism, we're tourism and finance and technology. We want to diversify our revenue base. But when it comes to the smallest economic unit of all, you or me, an individual, we're suddenly told, you know what, you only get one job. And it's going to be, we've made ourselves so fragile, like anything can break and then we're unemployed. But I think we should, there's other benefits to working many jobs at the same time, and one of them is economic resilience, so that we aren't screwed when we lose that job. And whether or not I think that's true, this is in effect happening, which is why I go back to what I said earlier. We need to get this basic income going, and we need to tie healthcare, retirement, workforce rules to apply to a case where people are doing many jobs at the same time.
We're out of time. She is Robin Chase, co-founder of Zipcar and author now of Peers, Inc., How People and Platforms Are Inventing the Collaborative Economy and Reinventing Capitalism. Thank you so much.
This was fun. Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Time of the season for love. Love songs are often dismissed as being sappy and whimsical, and are often overlooked by music critics. We were just talking about this with the critic Robert Christgau last week. But my next guest has written a whole book about this and says love songs are the most misunderstood genre of music, partly because historians have distorted its past. And in his new book, which is really a history book, Love Songs, The Hidden History, Ted Joya writes that, in fact, the love song deserves respect as the toughest and most battle-hardened mode of artistic expression, a phrase that you don't hear much about love songs, most battle-hardened. Joya is a music critic and historian and author of other books about music that you might know, including The History of Jazz, Work Songs, and Healing Songs, and he's a regular contributor to The Daily Beast. We're going to play some of the love songs that he cites from history in his book and sample from those. So welcome to WNYC, Ted Joya, today. Thanks so much for coming on. What a great book.
Thank you, Brian, for having me on the air.
So as I mentioned in the intro, before we get to some of these love songs from history, you've said the love song deserves respect as the toughest and most battle-hardened mode of artistic expression. Why do you put it that way?
Well, I was surprised during the course of my research. I had originally thought that love songs, the history of them, would be sentimental and lovey-dovey and full of soft romantic moments. But in fact, I discovered the exact opposite. I kept on uncovering situations of repression, prohibition, obviously censorship, sometimes even executions. And I only gradually realized what was going on. I asked myself, why is the history of this romantic music so bloody? And I figured out that the love song throughout history has been the agent by which people expand personal autonomy. They get more freedom, more human rights. People have to battle against patriarchal institutions and churches and community leaders and especially parents for the freedom to love in the way they want and the freedom to sing about love in the way they want. So in retrospect, it's not surprising, but I don't think people have understood that the love song itself is, in fact, much more controversial and battle-hardened than they realize.
That's quite a context. Is there a first love song in history or in known history that you identify in the book?
Well, you have to go back to ancient Mesopotamia, where they had these fertility rites and songs of these fertility rites. And people that have studied these will tell you, well, they're not really love songs. They're just about sex. And in fact, they are, because these were situations in which the king had to have sex with a goddess in order to preserve the society, to ensure good crops. Now, as you and I both know, it's hard to get a date with a goddess, so the high priestess had to step in for this, and she would compose these songs about her coupling with the king. Now, people that tell me these aren't really love songs, they're just sex songs, I say, well, people say the same about Miley Cyrus. So in many ways, we've just come full circle on the love song back to the fertility rites of ancient Mesopotamia.
I love this, can't get a date with the goddess, so you have to settle for the high priestess.
We don't know what she looked like, but I assume that the king was pleased.
So we're going to play some samples from notable love songs that you mention in the book, and you tell us the significance of these songs, okay? First one, Green Sleeves. Not the oldest love song ever, but one of the oldest that we were able to find a recording of that's mentioned in the book, written around 1600. Do you want to set this up for us at all?
Well, Greensleeves is a traditional folk song. We all know about it. But what we may not realize is the song is about a prostitute. And the reason why her sleeves are green is she's taking her clients to the cheapest place possible, which is just out on the grass. And so the song is from the point of view of either a prostitute or perhaps a woman who has been falsely accused of prostitution, who complains about being cast off so discourteously. So this is the erotic story behind the very tame traditional folk song, Greensleeves.
All right, a little instrumental rendition of Green Sleeves there. Does it count as a love song if it was to prostitutes or by prostitutes to potential clients?
Throughout most of history, prostitutes were also trained in the musical arts. Now, that's not something we expect nowadays, and so someone I'm going to Craigslist or wherever you go for these things probably isn't looking for that particular skill. But for the longest time, the prostitutes would sing in a very beguiling manner to the clients. And it would be a romantic posture, obviously, with other things implied as well. And, of course, this was very controversial. And the church was very much against love songs of all sorts throughout the Middle Ages, but especially those sung by prostitutes, which were a great source of fear and consternation for them.
Let's jump ahead to 1891. You write about Charles Harris's After the Ball, which you say is the first song to sell more than a million copies of its recording. This first million seller, tell us about it before we hear a little bit.
Well, this is from an age of American parlor ballads, and these were love songs that had to be suitable for your daughter to play in the parlor. And so it was an era of great sentimentality, of very cliched feelings, but still with this romantic, lonesome yearning about it. And to me, this epitomizes what the love song was in America before we had the blues and the jazz and all those elements from the African-American culture to spice it up.
After the ball is over, but after the break of morn, after the dancers leaving, after the stars,
really sounds like an old recording. Is that the 1891 original?
That could very well be. Point I'd just like to make, this is what our popular music might still sound like today if we didn't have that African-American element that entered the music in the 1920s, the 1930s. If you'd gone back to 1890 when this song came out and you asked people to predict the future of popular music, they would have looked to Europe. They would say, oh, go to the cabarets of Paris, go to Berlin. That's where the spicy love songs exist. In the United States, we were still singing these very sentimental songs. But then came this great revolution of blues and jazz. And it's because of that that America now dominates the world of commercial music and not Europe.
And let's hear an early sample of that. This is Bessie Smith, circa 1931. I want a little sugar in my bowl.
I need a little sugar in my bowl. I need a little hot dog on my roll. I can stand a bit of loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny. I feel so sad. I need a little steamy on my floor. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, hot papa? Come on and save your mama's soul. 'Cause I need a little sugar in my bowl. Doggone it.
I'm done. I'm just going to listen to Bessie Smith for the rest of the time until I go home.
Well, you can just see the huge leap that American popular music took during that interval from After the Ball to we get Bessie Smith, who's talking about her sexuality in a way that just didn't exist in American music before then. You know, it's interesting if you look at the commercial music industry in the early days of the 20th century. There was an enormous amount of censorship, but there were different rules for the black community. So when a piece of sheet music would come out that had a sexual content, like Won't You Come Home, Bill Bailey, or Frankie and Johnny, they would always put the picture of a black person or an entertainer in blackface on the cover of it. That signaled that it was okay to talk about sex in that song. And so then you have Bessie Smith, and eventually this all goes mainstream in America, but it takes 40, 50, 60 years before it moves out of the black community and the race records into the mainstream popular music.
And then I think you document in the book how, yeah, some of that music was known for how sex could be part of the love song, but then also how it moved back over time, I think as it got more mainstream acceptance in more of America, to more romantic lyrics.
There's always this push back and forth. You know, you go through these periods in which romance rises to the fore, and it's very introspective, and then you move to this more upbeat dance music. We saw that in the 70s, where you have the early 1970s, you have these moody singer-songwriters singing of romantic love. At the end of the decade, you have punk rock and disco. You've seen that also back in the 1930s. The beginning of the 1930s, you had these sentimental love songs. When you get to the late part of the decade, it's the swing era. So we keep on moving back and forth from these songs of introspective romance to these energized dance songs.
Where do you think we are today?
Well, I think you see things like this EDM music. I think you see this the heavy beat in all the current pop songs. I think we are in an era now where the danceable beat is more important than introspection and romance. And some people say, well, it's always going to be like this. They say, well, you know, sex sells and it's very primal. People don't want complex emotions. But I just think we're at one point on the cycle, and you're going to see a return to more of these introspective romantic love songs at some point. You know, maybe even you can see it now with songs like, you know, John Legend's All of Me. There are songs now that are sort of tapping into that more introspective vein.
The Sam Smith Stay With Me song of the year at the
Grammys. Well, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a classic example. And I think it tells you what people look for in a love song, which what I look for, I want something that's real, that's authentic. And you know, when Sam Smith got up to get the award, he said something that was wonderful. He said, I want to thank the person who broke my heart. Because of that, I've got all these Grammy Awards.
Right.
And I think that reinforces what people want from this music. They want to feel that, yeah, the music industry is commercial and it's about money and business, but we want to feel that there's still something real and some real heartache behind the songs.
Music historian Ted Gioia, our guest on WNYC, as we talk about his new book, Love Songs, The Hidden History. Let's sample from another one you write about, and this is going to be our Frank Sinatra moment. My Foolish Heart, of course, so many Frank Sinatra songs we could have chosen from. Before we hear a little bit, do you want to tell us why you mentioned this one?
Well, Sinatra to me was a huge breakthrough because he was the performer that understood you could sing love songs on two levels simultaneously. He always opens up his heart in a very heartfelt, emotional way. But there's also a part of Sinatra that's offering sort of this postmodern commentary on this song. There's a little bit of irony that he mixes in as well. And I think that became the template after Sinatra. Nowadays, the idea just to sing the love song straight is not as cool or as fashionable as doing what Sinatra did, which is I expose my heart, but I also step back and I still withhold something too.
Her lips are much too close to mine. Beware my foolish heart. But should our eager lips combine, then let that fire start. For this time it isn't fascination, or a dream that will fade and fall apart. It's love. This time it's love, my foolish heart. This time it's love.
Sinatra. With the big band, I always liked him when he had the big band settings more than the strings and stuff. But anything else you want to say that about that in the history of love songs context?
Well, you listen to Sinatra, and like I say, he's operating on these different levels. You feel that, yes, he loves you right now, but at the same time, there's a certain kind of flippancy and irony in his delivery, like, well, there might be someone else I would love tomorrow night. And the fact that he can bring those two levels together and succeed on both of them, I think, is a key to both his appeal and his influence.
In the book, you mentioned that documenting the history of love songs was so daunting because existing accounts of its past have omitted important information and included erroneous material. So what did you have to take a revisionist approach to?
The history of the love song is never been told accurately. The innovators in the love songs are outsiders, bohemians, slaves, prostitutes, marginalized people, and their contributions have, for the most part, been written out of the history books. Let me give just one example. When you ask scholars who invented the Western love song, they will give credit to the troubadours of the late medieval period who talked about being in service to the beloved and love was a kind of slavery. Well, in fact, there were earlier singers, these female singing slaves of the Islamic world, who anticipated all of this 100, 200 years before the troubadours. And they're completely written out of the history books. And they were singing about being in servitude to the beloved because, in fact, they were in servitude. They were actual slaves. But the slaves don't get credit for the music. It's the nobility of the south of France. The same thing happened in ancient China. It happened in ancient Rome where the performers were slaves. And it happened again in the United States where all this music came out of the slave culture and entered popular music. So the point I make in the book is, when you look at who gets credit, powerful people getting credit for this music, there's usually a hidden story behind it of a marginalized person who actually made the innovation.
Fascinating. Last thing. During your research, you reveal that you were forced to reconsider, based on the growing evidence of a biochemical link between music and sexual activity, something. What did you find out about this link that you can attribute to science?
Well, the starting point of my history of love songs and the starting point for anyone has to be Darwin, because Darwin said all music is a love song. Darwin believed that we sang as part of sexual selection, and he spent a lot of time looking at bird songs. In fact, if you read The Descent of Man, he spends four times as much time talking about bird songs as human music, because he thinks that all our songs are kind of mating song. I was very skeptical of this because he didn't talk about apes and chimpanzees who actually are lousy singers. And if you try to listen to chimpanzees fornicating, I can assure you there's no good music there. So I thought Darwin had overstated his case. But in the last 5-6 years, whole new evidence has come out of these hormones that are very closely connected with sexual activity and also with musical perception. And there's a growing body of evidence, biological evidence, that in fact survival of the fittest is to some extent survival of the most musical. So I've come begrudgingly to accept that Darwin was probably right about all this.
Now, listeners, we've been inviting your, your favorite love songs, and we've actually made a Brian Lehrer Show music stream that you can listen to on our website. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you can stream some of your fellow listeners' favorite love songs. So you can do that now, do it after the show. But what a fascinating interview, what a fascinating book. Ted Joy, a music historian, has written Love Songs, The Hidden History. Thank you so much.
Brian, thank you for having me.
We woke up in the kitchen saying, how the hell did this happen? Oh, baby. Drunk in love, we'd be all night.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Have a great weekend, everyone. The show will be back live on Monday.